Mr. Abrams, the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86957, John A. Liljeburg versus Health Services Acquisition Corp. Mr. Farr, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, our disagreement with the Fifth Circuit decision in this case rests upon two basic grounds. First, we think that final judgments should not be set aside because of after-the-fact recusal motions unless there is a showing of actual judicial impropriety. Second, we think that such relief is particularly inappropriate when at the time of judgment, the district judge did not even know of the possible grounds for recusal. Because a judge without knowledge cannot possibly favor one side or the other, it in fact is more unfair in this case to throw out the judgment than it is to give it effect. Now, I would like to spend just a few minutes at the outset on the facts of the case. The findings made by a separate district judge show that at the time that he rendered his judgment and at the relevant time when the case was before him, Judge Collins had no recollection of and no knowledge of any discussions between petitioner and Loyola University regarding the possible purchase of some Loyola land. The judge found that there were numerous individuals who had been discussing the possible purchase with Loyola, and that Judge Collins did not have any recollection that petitioner was among them. Now, the court will recall that this case did not involve Loyola University in any way. Loyola was not a party to the case. Its land was never mentioned in the case, and its interest was never mentioned in the case. There was a discussion of some land in the opinion, but that is, completely different land that has nothing to do with Loyola University. Judge Collins was said to have known at an earlier time, because he was present at some board meetings where the matter was discussed, and after his judgment, but the specific finding is that at the time of his judgment, he did not know. Now, I should take this opportunity to correct a misstatement I did make at the first argument, which was that he didn't have earlier knowledge either. The court did find that he had had earlier knowledge, but said that at the time that the case was before him, he did not have any knowledge of these discussions.
Now, is the finding that he did not know or did not remember?
I'm sorry, Justice?
Is the finding that he did not know or did not remember?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think the specific finding actually is stated in terms of knowledge, but I think it's implicit in that he would not have remembered any earlier information that he might have had by virtue of having attended the board meetings. Now, the Fifth Circuit did not reverse this finding. In fact, it reaffirmed that Judge Collins did not know at the time of his judgment about the discussions. What it held was simply that the judgment had to be set aside because, in effect, he should have known. Now, in discussing this decision, I would like to begin with what I think is an obvious but important point, that the question here is not simply one of getting another judge at the beginning of the case, which is what Section 455 is basically aimed at. The question here is one of setting aside a final judgment based on a motion that was made after the judgment was entered. Now, usually, this court has set a high threshold for claims raised for the first time after judgment. There, of course, are plain error rules on appeal and things like that. And for Rule 60B6, which is the rule under which this particular motion has been made, usually the court has required a showing of exceptional circumstances before it would find a basis for a judgment being set aside.
Mr. Farr, can I interrupt you? If you draw the line at when the judgment was entered, can you refresh my recollection? What was the date this judgment was entered?
The judgment, the judge signed the judgment on the 12th of March, and the judgment was entered formally on the 16th.
And what was the date when he found out about the possible appearance of impropriety arising out?
The date that the court is using is the 24th of March, perhaps the 25th, but I think the 24th.
And my question, and that's when the judgment had already been entered, what, in your view, was the trial judge's duty under the statute at that point in time?
I don't think that the judge, after the case that essentially his judgment had been entered, had any specific duty under the statute. I think, frankly, it would have been better practice, since it was so close to the time of judgment, if he'd informed the parties. But it would not make any difference to our position in this case, even if he had.
And what would you say if a motion had been made on, say, the 26th or 27th of March, whatever the dates were?
We would take exactly the same position,
it's
Justice Stevens. That's right. I mean, what we are talking about here is essentially a situation where he enters a judgment and he decides a case, and he has no reason to favor one party or the other. And although, as I say, I think it would have been better practice had he made that clear 8 days later, it would not have made any difference to the decision.
And if he'd happened to open his mail 3 or 4 days earlier, I guess there was just a couple of days before he got those letters, that would have been a critical difference, too, I guess.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that it would have. I mean, I guess it depends whether we're talking a couple of days, meaning before he had entered judgment. It possibly, I think at that case, then he, because the case would have still before him and he would have not entered a judgment, I think at that point he might well have had a duty to step aside and let another judge take over at that point.
I mean, might well. He would have knowledge.
That's right. I mean, that would be my understanding of the statute. The only reason, in fact, I use the phrase might well is there is the unusual circumstance in this case that he did announce his ruling from the bench.
Well, then he had no authority to rule on the 60B motion, did he?
Well, the question...
Or the new trial motion.
What happened, in fact, when the Rule 60B motion was filed, and it was filed approximately a year and a half after the time we're talking about now, he sought to reassign it to another judge for decision. However, they sent it back to him. At that time, he was no longer a trustee of Loyola University.
But as of March 24th, he was mandatorily disqualified from this case under any view, was he not?
That's correct.
And he had no authority to make any further rulings in the case.
As long as he was a trustee of Loyola University, that's correct. At the time that the motion was made before him, the Rule 60B motion, in fact, he was no longer a trustee of Loyola University. So, if, for example, if the case had been filed for the first time at that point, then he might well not have had any obligation to recuse himself.
Suppose he did not remember the fact that his wife owned this property. Let's assume that his wife owned the adjoining property. And as a result of his judgment, his wife is greatly enriched. Grounds for recusal?
If
mandatory recusal?
If there was a finding that he did not know about his wife's interest, Your Honor, I don't think there would be grounds for recusal.
Same case.
The specific statutory provision that we would be dealing with in terms of a wife's interest is Section B4, which specifically requires that he know of the interest before he is disqualified. Now, the question then would be, if he did not in fact know, if he sat in perfect good faith and in ignorance of this interest that his wife had, and that was part of the factual findings of the case, would that have then been a disqualifying interest? I think not.
Suppose you add the fact that he was negligent in not knowing.
Your Honor, I think again. I'm sorry?
Any difference?
No. I think the point that we were making here is that the remedy of throwing out a final judgment for something which is merely negligence is too strong a remedy, that there is no indication that in a situation like that that Congress intended that at any time that a judge inadvertently didn't know about something that could be a ground for recusal if he had known about it, that the judgments automatically ought to be thrown out.
Well, does the court below have discretion to set aside the judgment?
On the grounds...
Did the Fifth Circuit say this is automatic, that it had no choice?
Well, it accepted the finding and then said that it found that there was an appearance of impropriety. Our position certainly is that we don't see how there is an appearance of impropriety if a judge is sitting without knowledge of a possible disqualifying interest. Under those circumstances, what possible ground would he have to favor one side or the other? In that particular case, there isn't the kind of temptation, which in the words the court has used, that would lead him to hold the balance other than straight and true. It's only if he has knowledge of that.
Again, you're the same argument if he's negligent?
That's correct. That's correct. And we think that Congress, in fact, specifically framed subsection B in terms of knowledge for just that reason. Because if you say that as long as you can show that a judge should have known of something, just to take the negligent standard,
You're not ignoring appearances, are you?
Your Honor, I'm not ignoring appearances. What I'm saying is that here you have a specific finding that he didn't know. And I think that is a very important aspect of the question of how this appears.
No, stay at that time.
Everybody in the public knows
everybody
that.
Everybody but him.
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't that happen? Everybody but him.
He understood that he was a trustee. What he did not know is that there was any interest in the case before him.
But it seems to me the appearances are there.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm submitting here is that when you are talking about a situation where he, in fact, did not have knowledge, you can only create the appearance, essentially, by doubting the fact that he didn't have knowledge. You can say that...
Mr. Farr, isn't that the very point of the appearance of impropriety, that the public really doesn't know exactly what the judge's state of mind was or whether he remembered or deliberately forgot or what? And the appearance concept is designed to take care, in part, of public perceptions of acts when you don't, in fact, until months later, have a finding of fact that he didn't actually know.
Well, can I make 2 points about that, Justice Stevens? First of all, of course, the appearance standard is something which is supposed to be used on a going-forward basis. That is the normal intent of it, and the expectation is that...
On a what kind of standard? I didn't understand.
On a going-forward basis, on a prospective basis, that the facts will be known, and that is essentially a guideline for a judge to use in deciding whether to sit or, in fact, to transfer the case to another judge. And I think the question here is a somewhat more difficult one, which is, in a situation where he didn't know, would we just apply the same rule?
Would you say that 455A, which I think is the relevant provision here, can never be violated if the judge is not aware of the disqualifying fact? Say a person, judges do this, they have portfolios of stock and they forget they own 100 shares of some stock, but the newspapers check this up. And would you say there was no violation of that section? If the judge just honestly forgot about it, there was no appearance of impropriety.
I would say so in the example that you've given me, Justice Stevens. I have not been able to think of an example in which I think if a judge honestly did not know of any reason to be partial, that would legitimately create an appearance of partiality.
Let's suppose in this case everybody in town, he is a big booster for Loyola, has been, and everybody in town knows that he's a trustee of Loyola. And this is a big case, and the caption is Loyola versus somebody else. And he, for some very strange reason, forgets he's a trustee. And he continues to sit in that case. Don't you think that would create an appearance of impropriety? The only reason I thought you could argue there wasn't one here is that the impropriety didn't at all consist about the fact that, I mean, it was very hidden. Even the other side didn't realize that this land or that this company had a bid in on land, and if the company went under, the land would not be bought by that company, and the land belonged to Loyola. I can understand that that's no appearance of impropriety, because the public at large wouldn't know that. But the other hypo I just gave you, wouldn't that be an appearance of impropriety?
But, of course, in that case, Justice Scalia, I can't imagine that there would be a determination that he didn't know about it, that... In a situation where, to begin with, just to give you a technical answer, there is a...
Oh, it's my hypothetical. I mean, there is a determination that he didn't know about it.
And that finding is made on the basis of a record, is accepted by the Court of Appeals.
Then there's no appearance?
I think in a situation where he does not know about the particular grounds to give rise to recusal, that the appearance can only be achieved essentially by not accepting the finding. But that's the kind of situation, the problem is that while that may be a situation that happens in lots of cases where people looking at it say, here is a particular finding that a judge has made and I personally don't accept it, if you follow that course with Section 455A or even 455B, you're going to open up all sorts of situations where the findings are controlling.
Yes, but under your view, as I understand you, you really won't know whether there was an appearance of impropriety until you've had a finding of fact on the judge's state of his knowledge.
Well, Justice Stevens, I think that occurs in lots of cases, whether it's not something a judge knew or whether it's something a judge did or something a judge said.
I'm not disagreeing with you that isn't true, but that's a little different from one's normal concept of what an appearance of impropriety is, even though it seems to me the appearance either exists or it doesn't exist, and there's sometimes a wholly innocent explanation for it, but
right.
It seems to me that doesn't really affect the public perception of the way the judges work. See, the public sometimes is suspicious of us, even though they really shouldn't be.
Well, except I think that 455A talks in terms of reasonable suspicion. Now, I suppose the public may be suspicious, even after a judge has said, there is no basis here for believing that this judge did anything wrong. The public looks at it and says, gee, if we've been the judge, we think something looks worse than that. We're troubled about
Mr.
that.
Mr. Farr, how does subsection C enter into this that says that the judge should inform himself about his personal and fiduciary financial interests and make a reasonable effort and so forth?
Okay,
does that enter into the picture at all?
I don't think it enters into this picture, Justice O'Connor, and let me try to explain why. At the first argument, I indicated why I thought that that particular section didn't really apply here, because Section B4 says knows, not should know, and there's nothing in C about a conclusive presumption. But I would like to supplement that answer by pointing to the particular language of subsection C, because I think under any reading of subsection C, the knowledge that we are talking about here is not the kind of knowledge that he would be conclusively presumed to know under C, even if it does have a conclusive presumption. What Judge Collins is said not to have known in this case is the names of possible purchasers of land from Loyola University. And if you look at what he is required to know under C, or what he's required to inform himself about, are fiduciary financial interests. And financial interests is defined in terms of ownership of a legal or equitable interest.
What about the hypothetical that you were asked about the spouse owning shares of stock, and he deals with a case involving that company?
Well,
don't you think that C suggests he should know that his wife owns the stock?
Let me say that C, of course, in the hypothetical of his wife, there is a reasonable efforts clause under C, not a specific knowledge clause. The legislative history gives an example, which Justice Traynor gave, of the difficulty of asking one's spouse about his or her investments, and indicates that they particularly had a lower threshold in that situation. But anyway, to answer your question, Justice O'Connor, I think that there might be a possible reading under C which says that the way we are going to enforce the provisions of subsection C is to assume that a judge knows at least about what he's required to inform himself about and perhaps what he is supposed to make reasonable efforts about. But even if that were so, that still wouldn't mean he would have to know not just what he owned, what his wife owned, what any private trust that he served as a trustee owned, or any university, but also anybody who might buy that.
Than this one, then, do you concede that C affects A in the sense, at least to the extent, that the judge is supposed to inform himself about his own personal interests?
I guess I think it's possible, Justice O'Connor. I don't believe I need to win those cases, so I think the easy thing to do would be just to say yes. But I quite honestly am not sure that even in that situation that the remedy of invalidating a final judgment or all prior rulings would be proper just because he didn't carry out the duty under C. C essentially is an ethical requirement. It's in the Code of Judicial Ethics.
Was there a finding that he did comport with his duties under C in this case?
Your Honor, there was no specific finding about that at all, but what I'm saying...
It seems to me that there couldn't very well have been. He's a fiduciary, and he has an obligation to make sure of what his beneficiary's interests are, and this was not a small potatoes deal, as I understood it. Didn't Loyola stand to have its adjacent land increased tremendously in value if this hospital went through?
That was the finding of the court, that this was an important interest to Loyola. But let me explain again the situation in which this comes up.
And doesn't the judge have the duty to inquire, as a fiduciary, of all of the interests of Loyola, just to make sure that this doesn't happen?
Well, what I would like to point out here is that even if the judge had carried out that duty to its fullest degree, at least that I think is contemplated about C, had learned everything that Loyola owned, that still would not have been enough to put him on notice necessarily about the case that was in front of him. I mean, obviously, if Loyola University had been a party or its land had been mentioned in the case, then you could say, well, he's supposed to know that they own the land, and he then would recognize, he should recognize when it was mentioned. But what we're talking about here is a series of board meetings. We're really talking about, I guess, three board meetings over a period of several years in which the name of the petitioner and the corporation he owns are mentioned on a couple of occasions. And if...
Well, not only that, but the hospital project. You would think that would stick in his mind.
Well, except it was one of numerous things that they were talking about doing with this particular piece of land. I think to some extent you have to put yourself in the position that a trustee is in at these board meetings, where you are talking about numerous items that come up, for example, and any report by the real estate committee, for example, is one of 10, a dozen, 20 things that are discussed at a meeting. And even then, the idea of using this as a hospital was one idea. The idea of using it as a shopping center was another idea. There's a part in the minutes about somebody wanting to use it for parking.
That was what I was going to mention. There were minutes of all these meetings.
There were minutes of all
which he was supposed to have read.
He said that what he did was scanned the minutes.
Anybody in the public assumes that a trustee reads the minutes.
Well, he said that he scans the minutes of the meeting, but that he took no particular interest in these financial dealings. And one of the things that I think is important to note...
How can you convince the public of that?
Well, I think...
That a judge doesn't understand what he's reading.
Well, I think a judge has to... that the public has to understand the position that a judge is in, particularly as a fiduciary of an institution like a university. The Code of Judicial Ethics, in fact, prohibits a judge from taking an active interest in the financial affairs of Loyola University. He's not allowed to do that ethically. He can be a trustee for certain kinds of private trusts, and he can serve in a fiduciary capacity for public institutions, but he cannot take an active role in the finances.
Well, did he, in this case, make his position clear?
He did not take an active role in Loyola's finances. In fact, that's precisely what he said.
Did he make that clear to the public? Did he make that clear to the public or anybody else?
He testified under oath to that effect. Yes, he did.
And he made it clear to whom?
When a Rule 60 motion was filed a year and a half afterwards.
That's not what I'm talking about. You said that under the law he has to do this. Well, did he do that? Did he make it clear that he was not interested in the fiduciary doings of that place? Did he?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question, quite honestly.
Say that I, pursuant to the laws of the state of California, am not allowed to participate in the fiduciary business of this corporation?
Your Honor, I don't know that he did that, but I do know that he did not serve on the real estate committee, he did not serve on the investment committee, he did not serve on the executive committee.
Did he disqualify himself from every vote on every financial transaction that came before?
No, indeed, the Code of Ethics allows you to vote as a general trustee on financial matters. What it does not allow you to do, however, is to actually participate in making the financial decisions. And I think what is happening is that, in a sense, we are looking to impose on Judge Collins.
Do you think it's appropriate for a judge to vote on a matter, a financial matter, in which is also appearing before his court?
Do you think it's appropriate for
a judge to vote on a financial matter and financial transaction that's being reviewed in his court?
No, I don't. No, I think if he knows that there is a financial matter, either at the board meeting or in his court, that he should not vote on it if it is in his court, or he should recuse himself if the matter is before him in his courtroom. But those are cases, of course, where we're talking about knowledge. And what we're talking about here is a situation where Judge Collins could not reasonably have had any reason to favor one party or the other. And the question really then is it appropriate?
Was that finding made by the lower court?
Pardon me?
Was that finding made by the lower court?
Not that specific finding, but the finding that he had no knowledge. It seems to me it follows naturally from that if you don't know about any reason to be partial, that there is no reason that you would favor one party over the other. And the court below accepted his testimony to the effect that he did not know at the time he sat in the case. Now, I'd just like to make one brief point and then save the remainder of my time, if I may. The type of thing we are talking about, the issue of allegations about a judge and what is determined and then what the public believes, does come up in several different kinds of cases. And in response to Justice Stevens' question, I wanted to say that there are cases, for example, where there is an allegation made that a judge made an out-of-court statement to a third party, which indicates some sort of bias or prejudice. And in each of those cases, there is then a question as to whether, in fact, the judge made the statement. And there have been fact findings. There's a case in the Seventh Circuit, Ballastrieri, the Ninth Circuit, Confort, and the Fifth Circuit, Brown, which are examples of this. Sometimes the fact finding is not favorable to the judge. That was the situation in the Brown case. And sometimes it is, but it is that finding, whether he said it or what he said, that is then used as the basis for application of the statutory provision.
Mr. Farr, in this case, the facts that give rise to the violation of 455A, if there was a violation of 455A, would exist before the finding occurred, whereas the ones you described depend on whether the statement was made, which is an objective fact, yes or no. This turn. What you're in effect saying is later on you want to know the subjective state of mind of the judge here to determine whether there was an appearance. And I would suggest the appearance might well have existed, even though he didn't realize there was a disqualifying fact.
Well, I guess I do at some point part company on that the question of whether there really
is. Let me just get one.
Is it your position
that 455A was not violated, or that the vacation of a judgment is an impermissible remedy for a violation of 455A?
It is both. Our initial position, as I meant to indicate, was that this is not a permissible remedy or not an acceptable remedy simply for an appearance of impropriety when you're talking about a motion filed after the fact. That's what the Seventh Circuit rule is. What I am saying in addition, though, is that because of the finding of lack of knowledge,
I think
if you credit that, there fairly isn't even an appearance of partiality in this case. Thank you. I'll reserve my time for that.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Lucas.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we submit to Your Honors that the single most important finding of fact by the Fifth Circuit was its finding that the public would not believe that Judge Collins forgot. If the public wouldn't believe that Judge Collins forgot, it would therefore believe that his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. It would therefore believe that the judgment was tainted, and the requirements of 455A would then have been met. And that was basically, I believe, the foundation of the Fifth Circuit's holding. Fifth Circuit also said that the judge erred in failing to recuse himself.
Excuse me, that would show that he should disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably have been questioned. And this says might reasonably be questioned. The proceeding was over. At the time it was conducted, there was no reason for the public to question his impartiality. What you're saying is that the public won't believe that that his colleague's finding that he didn't know about it was true, right?
At the time...
Later.
At the time of the hearing, I believe the public would question his impartiality, yes. If the public knew, he was a member of the board then.
The public didn't know. But the public didn't know. At the time of the proceeding, even the parties didn't know, who were much more familiar with all the land involved in the case and all of that. It's hard to believe that the public would have known.
The public, I believe, for purposes of 455A, is presumed to know objective facts. The objective facts were that before that hearing, during that trial, this man, this judge, was a member of the Board of Trustees of Loyola University. At that time, the public is expected to know that, yes. I don't think it matters when we learned it. Justice Scalia, I really don't.
It's supposed to know. The public is deemed to know every little detail, even though he's unaware of those details, and even though he has no obligation to inform himself of those details.
No, I don't think the public is deemed to know every little detail, and that's where the importance comes in. I think the public is to know that if Loyola owns a 530-acre tract of land, which is what this is, the equivalent of about 17 square city blocks, and if it's going to sell a piece of that land, and it's going to have rezoned 115 acres around it, which will increase the value by $9 million, I think those facts the public would expect to be important and would know.
But the public didn't know the connection between this company and that land any more than the judge here did. And so do you seriously contend that at the time the judgment was rendered, there was an appearance of impropriety?
Yes. Yes.
There was. Who, to whom was this appearance manifest?
To the
public. Your client didn't find out about it until how much later?
Well.
Maybe you're guilty of latches then.
Well, then, too, maybe the court is guilty of not having revealed it, as it's required to do and mandated to do. When it knew it, it didn't tell the parties. It didn't tell the attorneys. I don't think that that under those circumstances that we should look back and say, hey, in other words, if a judge could, it seems to me, Justice Scalia, that if a judge could just keep to himself some interest that would require his recusal under 455A, if he could just keep it to himself until after the judgment's rendered, all's well.
No, because then he would come under another provision where he has personal bias or prejudice, or where he actually knows of a financial interest. But here you're just saying he didn't know of it. I mean, that's quite different. Here you're saying this judgment was bad because it appeared that he was biased, and I find it hard to say that at the time of the judgment there was any appearance of impropriety.
Justice Scalia, we don't say he didn't know. The judge himself said he didn't remember. He knew on January 24, 1980. The court found that as a finding of fact. He knew on September 25, 1981. He knew on November 12, 1981, and that's an important date because on that date he attended a meeting. He voted on a motion that was passed unanimously, or presumably he voted. He was there, and the motion passed unanimously, to resume negotiations with Mr. Liljeburg. 18 days later, the suit was filed, and 29 days later, he denied a TRO and refused to stay in an injunction in that suit 29 days after that meeting.
You tried this and lost, didn't you?
Sir?
Didn't you argue this to the district court?
Lost on the merits.
And
yes.
Lost on the merits.
Yes, sir.
You don't want to try that again here. Don't we have to accept the fact that he didn't know? Isn't that how the posture in which this case is going forward?
No. I don't think. I think what is before the court is the Fifth Circuit saying the Judge Schwartz particularly saying he didn't remember. I think there's a difference between he didn't remember and he didn't know. He did know initially. Now, they were in the area of did he know and then forget. That's really what we're saying.
When did you or your client find out that he was on the board?
We found out, sir, 10 months after the judgment was rendered by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
You mean that you tried that case against the corporation and you never examined its minutes? Did you ever examine the minutes of the Loyola?
No, Loyola was not a party to the suit, Justice.
I know, but it was involved.
No, it was not involved. It was not involved in the suit. The suit was over the ownership of a corporation which in turn owned a certificate of need to build a hospital which was going to be built if Mr. Liljeburg was successful on Loyola property.
But it was the property of Loyola.
On which it would be built, yes.
And you didn't look at the minutes?
Didn't even know any connection between Loyola and Mr. Liljeburg.
Wait a minute, don't say you didn't even know there were minutes.
No, sir. Didn't know any connection between Mr. Liljeburg and Loyola.
No, but I mean, you never looked at the minutes, you say. I just think it's strange. At the minutes, you would have known he was a trustee. Wouldn't you?
No. Well, sir, I'm perhaps not making myself clear. I had no reason to look at Loyola's minutes because Loyola wasn't a party to the suit. I had no idea at that time that a hospital would be built on Loyola's property. It could have been built anywhere. So there was no reason to suspect. Loyola played no part in this case.
You know more than the general public had any reason to believe there was any impropriety. I mean, that seems to me very telling. And yet you assert that there was an appearance of impropriety. Although you didn't see any.
I did see, I can see impropriety in the fact that the judge knew on March the 24th, 2 days before the court, before he lost jurisdiction of this case, didn't phone anyone, didn't tell anyone, had a mandatory duty to recuse himself at that point.
That might be actual bias or actual impropriety, but it wouldn't be an appearance of impropriety, which is, I thought, what we're talking about.
The discovery did not disclose that St. Jude was negotiating with Loyola as a prospective seller of the land?
No. No, sir, it did not. The discovery on the merits of the case, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, no, sir, did not. No.
You just assumed a hospital would be built somewhere?
No, where the hospital was going to be built was really of no concern. You see, this was a contest between HSAC, which is a subsidiary of Hospital Corporation of America, and Mr. Liljeburg, who was negotiating with other companies. HSAC had land on which to build a hospital and which the state had approved as a site for the hospital. So where the hospital was going to be built was really no concern to us if Mr. Liljeburg won. We were concerned with him not winning.
When the judge failed to disclose his interest on March the 24th, how did that prejudice you? I take it counsel for the petitioner and the appellant argues that it really didn't make any difference at that point. The trial was over anyway.
Well, again, looking back on it, a number of things could have happened. Number one, the judge, on his own motion under Rule 59, could have declared a new trial right then and there. On the night of March 25th, the last date, March 25th of 82, the last date that it was still under Judge Collins' jurisdiction, he attended a meeting at which the details of this land transaction were discussed. Those minutes are before Your Honors. No phone call, certainly not to me, to anyone else that I know about, to say, or even on March 26th, 7th, or 8th, hey, I hear you're appealing this case. I think you ought to know. And the onus is not on the lawyers, Your Honors. As I read the statute and the jurisprudence, the onus is on the judge.
But what conclusion do we draw from that? That it would have been easier for you to make your motion, but does it tell anything about what the substantive ruling on the motion would have been? We're back in the same box that we're in now, that is to say the trial is over.
No, except that, of course, one of the arguments that's raised is the question of, by opposing counsel, is the question of timeliness. Of course, it is directly involved there. We were in a position where it was 10 months after the court of
appeals. What about the merits?
The merits?
The merits of the recusal motion or the new trial motion. Those are the same, aren't they, on March the 24th and 10 months later? Or are they?
Yes, I think they are. I think so. Yes, Justice Kennedy. Now, one of the points that, of course, this Court is well aware of is that a judge should not act as a judge in his own case. And this Court, in Aetna versus Lavoie, established that principle. Also, the law does not look at just actual bias, but it looks at the question of the appearance of bias or the appearance of impropriety. And this was an important holding by the court in Commonwealth Coatings case back in 1968. In fact, it was that case that was used as a source of 455A in the Senate and House hearings. Therefore, in the absence of a designation of a remedy in Section 455, the remedy applied by this court in Commonwealth Coatings is reasonable. I was asked before at the earlier hearing as to the basis for any remedy under 455, and I think that the basis for that remedy is the Commonwealth Coatings case. I don't think that I or anyone else will ever know what's only known to Judge Collins. I think a terrible situation would face this court and this nation and under this statute if we ever got into a position where a judge who stands in the position of the person being tried, and I would cite the court to U.S. versus Brown, in the purview of a fair trial, it's the judge himself who is on trial. If we ever get to a situation where the judge can say, I forgot or I don't remember, and completely exculpate himself from any finding of impartiality, then I think we would do violence under those circumstances to the congressional intent of 455A. I think that the cases have clearly established that we must rely upon objectively ascertainable evidence rather than the judge's memory or the judge's professing of not remembering.
Mr. Lucas, that wouldn't be, I mean, it wouldn't, such a holding wouldn't stretch as far as you're suggesting. I mean, if the thing that he claims not to have remembered is something obvious to all the public, and he's the only one in the world that didn't remember it, then you could say, whether he remembered it or not, there was an appearance of impropriety, because the whole public knew that this land was involved in the litigation and that he was a trustee of Loyola. But it's a much narrower situation when you say it's a little thing that the public wouldn't know about, and it's that he claims not to remember. What's so bad about letting that be adjudged by a separate court, and if the court is persuaded that he did not remember it, there has neither been an appearance of impropriety nor any actual impropriety?
Well, Justice Scalia, I think we get back to the question of, is it a little thing or is it a big thing? Here it was a big thing. Here it was a case of a judge who attended three meetings where this matter was discussed apparently in detail, and the suggestion has been made he only heard it one or two or three times.
Well, you're mistaking what I mean by a little or big thing. I mean a thing that's evident at the time of the trial. This was not evident at the time of the trial. Your client didn't pick it up. It was a very remote connection. Now, maybe he should have remembered it, but he didn't, or at least it was found that he didn't.
But I believe it is presumed that the that the public knows whatever the facts were at that time, not later. Whether the public finds out later or not is inconsequential. So we look at the facts at that time. The facts at that time were he had any number of meetings. He got any number of minutes.
I think that's the essence of what we're debating about here,
yes.
whether you use what the public reasonably knew at the time or what every detail of the fact was at the time. I think you're right that if you say that that's the basis on which you do it, then there was an appearance of impropriety.
I think that...
Were there findings on when both parties knew, when Liljeburg knew?
Sorry, Justice Kennedy.
Were there any findings as to when Liljeburg knew of the judge's trustee position?
That never entered the case, and that's another point. Presumably, he was negotiating for quite a while, as later developed at depositions taken after the motion to vacate was filed. Yes. That was never revealed to us. He was negotiating the whole time. So,
may I ask along that line, Mr. Lucas, something that's always puzzled me, that in the minutes of January 22nd meeting, which I guess was, what was the date of the trial? It was right about the time of the...
The trial was January 21, 22, yes, sir, of 82.
The minutes of the Real Estate Committee on January 22 refer to the negotiation with St. Jude Hospital Corporation that Mr. Eckholt reported that the federal courts have determined that the certificate of need will be awarded to the St. Jude Corporation. That quite obviously refers to the judge's oral ruling from the bench.
22nd, yes, sir.
But is there anything in the record to tell us how the Loyola trustees came to be aware of that fact?
No, sir. I don't know.
Or whether they perhaps warned the judge he shouldn't be sitting in a case like this or anything like that?
No. I can only say I don't know. I don't know. Obviously, they were keeping track of the case.
Because the Loyola people were keeping track of the case.
Again, I must stress the fact that we did not know. When I say we, HSAC did not know of Loyola's nexus with this proceeding until 10 months after the Court of Appeal judgment, the U.S. Fifth Circuit's judgment. I would like to also point out one thing that I think is also very worthy of consideration, and that is 455 applies to criminal cases as well as applies to civil cases. I think if we were to give the interpretation that petitioners wish to give to 455, then in U.S. versus Brown, the defendant would still be in jail, or at least he would have served out his sentence, because despite the fact that there was a great impropriety in that case, the judgment had already been rendered. It was some 8 years later between the time that the man was tried and the time of the reversal. He'd still be in jail because it was not a case of actual bias. He couldn't proceed that way. It was a remark that the judge made that didn't come to light until after the trial, after the trial was over. So if we give the construction to this statute that once judgment's rendered, that's it. Or once an appeal is exhausted, that's it. And I submit to your honors that an injustice in the criminal field as well as the civil could well take place.
You'd apply a preponderance of the evidence standard in a criminal case to determine whether the judge in fact knew of the biasing fact, or don't you think you'd have to apply a beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
I don't know, Jan, I confess that I'm out of my field when we're talking about criminal law.
If there is more than a 50% chance that the judge wasn't biased, we're going to let the person go to jail? I doubt that.
This judge, in effect, acted as a judge in his own case. Once simply by saying, I don't remember, I forgot, is taken as the basis for saying that he would not be responsible under 455A. To the contrary, the Fifth Circuit finding that the public would not believe that he was impartial said that he, because of constructive knowledge, things that he should have known, that he had a duty to inquire into, Justice O'Connor, under C, require that he be found to have had the requisite knowledge to indicate his impartiality under 455A. The record clearly establishes that Justice Collin has attended board meetings on these three occasions that I've mentioned. Again, I wish to particularly stress the November 21, 1981 board meeting, 29 days before he ruled on a preliminary matter in this case, which you will find on page 1 of the joint appendix. Within 29 days, and we, members of the public, have to ask ourselves, if we were on a board of trustees that was getting ready to sell a piece of property that had been discussed at a number of meetings we attended, that was one of the principal assets of this company, of this institution that we serve, and the surrounding land was going to be increased in value by $9 million, we would forget that, and we voted on the motion to renew the negotiations with these people, Lilsberg and St. Jude. Would we, 29 days later, remember that? I think we would. And I think that under that construction, the court properly found that the public would not believe Judge Collins forgot. Thus, it's not a question, really, of whether he knew or he didn't know, whether he forgot or he didn't forget. It's a question of whether the public would find that based upon the relevant objective facts, it appeared that the judge was not impartial. From the beginning, this court has said that justice must satisfy the appearance of justice, and that the imprimatur must be placed on a sound judicial system that has the support of the people. And I believe that was the purpose of 455A. 455A is not to be applied in a speculative manner, not just any situation, not just something, Justice Scalia, it seems to me, that involves something quite minor, should be used to jump upon and to try to set aside a judgment. I certainly don't think that that's the meaning that was ever intended to be given to it. But in a situation of extreme facts, strong facts, compelling facts, as we have in this case, that is the only only vehicle by which we can preserve our right to a fair trial, if you will, a fair trial in a fair tribunal, which is, after all, the purpose of the statute. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Lucas. Mr. Farr, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Counsel talked briefly about Aetna Life Insurance versus Lavoie, and I think the decision of this court in that case points out what I think is a very important part of this case, which is there is a difference between a judge who sits knowing of a possible interest and a judge who sits when he doesn't know it. In Lavoie, the court did hold that one of the justices of the Alabama Supreme Court should be disqualified because he sat knowing of an interest. The court also was asked, however, to disqualify all of the other judges of the court because they were class members. And in discussing that claim, this court pointed out that they were not even aware of any interest in the case when they sat on it, at least up until the time of the rehearing. And the court assumed, and I think correctly, that they could not have had any reason to be biased, at least up until the time that they knew about it. I think what this case really is coming down to from the gist of respondents' argument is the question as to whether you believe Judge Collins or not. And he says reasonable people in this case will not believe him. And if, in fact, he did something wrong, certainly the judgment should be thrown out. But the question is, what facts do you have to follow through on in order to reach that conclusion? You have to assume, first of all, that Judge Collins sat in a case violating his judicial oath, knowing that a university that he served as a trustee had an interest, and yet sat to favor that interest. When it was called to his attention 18 months later in a motion, He falsely denied that he didn't know about it.
It was called to his attention very, very much more promptly than 18 months.
Well, when it was called to his attention, but at that time, as he testified, he said the case was disposed of.
But don't you agree at that point he had a duty to do something more than he did?
I agree at that time it would have been better practice.
I think he had a duty to do something more than he did.
I don't agree, Justice Stevens. I think at that point it would not have made any difference.
I don't think he had a duty to disclose to the parties what the true facts were.
As the Fifth Circuit said in addressing that issue, it would have been better had he done so.
I understand. Everybody knows it would have been better.
And he certainly would have, should have
refused. If it just would have been better, then you're saying he had no duty to disclose at that point.
At that point, I don't believe he had a duty to do so. But let me return. Even if he did, I think at that point it just would have been a matter of recusing himself from any motions, and there were none made at that time. But let me again go back to these facts. Judge Collins was – the motion was made to Judge Collins. Judge Collins says, I did not know about it. His deposition is taken under oath. He says, I did not know about it. Judge Schwartz makes a finding that says he did not know about it. And three judges on the Fifth Circuit say, we accept that finding. We don't believe Judge Collins knew about it either.
And in each of those instances, you can substitute the word remember for the word know.
That's correct. That's correct.
It's rather hard for one federal judge to call another one a liar, isn't it?
Well, as I've indicated before, Your Honor, there is a procedure set up for disciplining judges, which Congress set up 6 years after it amended 455, that depends on judges taking responsibility for the conduct of other judges.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.